Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Our next guest, I have known him for just about 18 years. I came to the Oregonian, my job interview. They said, all right, you're going to sit down with Ken Goh. And I thought, oh, man, this sounds serious. And I sat down with him and found that Ken Goh was one of the smartest, best journalists that I had ever met. And my opinion of him has only improved over 18 years. And he joins us now. Ken Goh, did they make you meet with everybody back in the day when people were coming in for jobs?
No, just the MVPs.
Well played. You wrote about Steve Prefontaine. And yes. I'm interested in Pre and sort of the legend of Pre but I didn't know much about it because I've only been here 18 years. Why do you think Pre has that mystical long-standing impact?
He died young, I think, is part of it. I mean, when you're very successful and an iconoclast and charismatic, and then you die young, you're forever frozen in people's minds as that person he was at 24. And it's hard to know what he would be doing now if he was still alive. But at that point, it was an interesting time for track and field because it was considered an amateur sport at the Olympic level when those athletes clearly had value. And he was challenging that orthodoxy. And it was a time when young people in a lot of aspects of life were challenging what was considered orthodoxy. And I think that resonated. And then, you know, he won. He won and he didn't apologize for winning. You know, it's, sort of the Al Davis approach, just win, baby. He got out. He didn't. If you watched, I don't know how much your listeners care about distance running, but most distance runners, successful distance runners, lay back, conserve their energy, stay close to the front, and then kick, you know, and finish really strong and try to come maybe not out of the back, but not from the front, because being in front takes a lot more energy. If you're leading the race and you're not drafting off anybody, it's hard. But that's how he won. He went in front. He challenged people. He ran from in front. So I think all those things resonated with people at that time, and those qualities are still qualities that resonate with people.
How much is his impact felt still today? Eugene, University of Oregon, I know that it's a cool thing to kind of bring him out, but is he still part of the fabric of that?
I think so. And a lot of that's because of his influence on Nike. Those qualities that I just talked about are the qualities that Phil Knight and Bill Bowerman wanted to instill in their company when they founded it. And those are qualities that the people that run Nike still respect and hope their company exemplifies. So, yeah, I mean, it's usually important. Nike basically bankrolls USA Track and Field. It has a huge influence on the University of Oregon and the University of Oregon track program. Phil Knight just built it's one of the track stadiums in the world, certainly the finest in this part of the country, this part of the world, you know, in North and South America. There isn't a better one. So, yeah, I mean, that influence that Steve Prefontaine had at the time, he still has.
It's kind of like, you know, you look at boxing, you need a heavyweight champion. I think in track and field, we've always looked at the sprinters, or maybe I have. I've looked at the Usain Bolts of the world and Michael Johnson in the 200 and 400, and I've said, okay, those are the heavyweight champions. But to have a distance runner that had personality and impact and influence, can you see that happening again? Could a distance runner come on the scene, an American distance runner, and do that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because the sport isn't what it was in the 1970s. It doesn't have that mass appeal. It's become sort of a niche sport, or it's a sport that a few people care a lot about, and most people don't understand or pay much attention to. So I don't know. The people that run track and field in the United States are hoping that the World Outdoor Championships that will be held in Eugene in 2022 provide that spark to where people start paying attention to the sport again, and maybe some young charismatic athlete in track and field, be he sprinter or distance runner or thrower or jumper, emerges and captures the people's attention, sort of the way happened when the Women's World Cup was first, Soccer World Cup was in the United States. I think that sort of galvanized people at that time, but it remains to be seen whether track will be able to pull that off.
Ken Goh of the Oregonian, OregonLive.com, is our guest. I think one of the things that makes you special, Ken, is you got versatility as a journalist. You could cover news, you can cover sports, you can cover a variety of sports, you write opinion, you can write an investigative piece or an analysis, and I think that really is a valuable asset in today's journalism world. Where did you develop that? Like, let's go back, let's talk about you a little bit. Where do you think you got that range that you have?
Well, I'm going to tout liberal arts education a little bit. I wasn't a journalism major. I didn't go to school to study to be a newspaper reporter. I was a history/communications major at Lewis and Clark, which was a little liberal arts school. And one of the things liberal arts education is about is trying to get you familiar with a lot of different areas. And so when you major at a liberal arts school, you're taking a lot of other kinds of classes too. And at Lewis and Clark, we were encouraged to go overseas. I spent 5.5 months in Great Britain as a college sophomore, which was a great broadening experience, both to learn about the world and to learn about yourself. And in 1974, that's how long ago I was a high school sophomore, there was no mass communications. There were no cell phones. You could make a call to the United States, but it was prohibitively expensive. So you were basically adrift other than, the professor who led the overseas study program and a handful of students. And so you had to learn, how to navigate another culture. And Great Britain wasn't like going to China or something, but it was different. And when you look back on the country in a lot of different ways from a different perspective, you see things that you didn't see before.
Ken Goh with us. College football is positioning to play. I think it's interesting that we've gone from will they play to they will play in a matter of weeks, and then now trying to figure out, okay, who gets in the stadium or not. How do you think that should be determined? And how big of a piece of the pie is that at Oregon and Oregon State in particular for you?
Well, it's huge. I think we've talked before about what a revenue driver college football is for major college athletic programs. The in-stadium attendance is vital in a number of ways. You have the ticket prices, you have the seat licenses that people pay to get the tickets, you have concessions, you have merchandise that's sold at the stadium, you have parking. That's a lot of different revenue streams that are in danger if there's no fans in the stadium. I think the Pac-12 is certainly hoping to have at least some fans in the stadium, because if they don't, that's a big revenue stream that's drying up. And right now, I think athletic departments around the country are trying to figure out how they're going to pay for their athletic programs. Some of the smaller Division I schools are dropping men's sports because they can't drop women's sports and keep football. So because of Title IX, you have to offer equivalent opportunities for men and women, and there's no women's equivalent to football. So you can't start dropping women's sports. So, I don't think universities necessarily want to do this, but you got to pay for it somehow, right? And if you don't have your football program or your football program operating at reduced capacity, then you don't have money to do a lot of the things you want to do.
Ken, I also think, you know, one of the scenarios that was floated during all of this was the Pac-12 just playing a Pac-12 only schedule, and everybody kind of moved on from that. But there was a piece of that that I really loved. It sort of deprioritized the college football playoff, which I think is great if you are among those competing. But playing a conference-only schedule might bring back some of that provincial pride. And, hey, winning a conference championship was what it is supposed to be about back in the day.
Yeah, and another thing it would do is everybody would be playing by the same rules, right? Right now, each conference and each state is sort of laying out what is going to be permissible because of the coronavirus. And the Pac-12 is insisting on a uniform approach as best it can within the different states it operates in. So you'd have you wouldn't have Arizona playing by a different set of rules than Washington would, for the most part. once you start playing non-conference games, then you lose that lever. And right now, for instance, Larry Scott, the Pac-12 commissioner, has said he wants Pac-12 athletes to be tested regularly, which is good. But it's also expensive. And I don't know if North Dakota State, which Oregon plays, or Portland State, which Oregon State plays, has the resources to be able to do that. So you're putting yourself in a position where you have one school operating in a manner that they think is best possible to keep its athletes and its coaches and its support personnel safe. And you have another school that can't afford to do that. So it's not a level playing field in terms of athlete, player, coach health.
Ken Goh of the Oregonian is with us. Ken, we cover sports, college football and college basketball in particular, and we look at the NBA and in the NFL, and we see sports that have a majority of African-American athletes. My experience, I'll speak for me alone, I'm white. My experience is very narrow. And when I cover athletes, I'm well aware that they are successful in other parts of their life, but we spend a lot of time focused on what happens on the court, on the field, writing about them through that lens. I'm struggling right now with what my role is and what the role of sports journalists are when it comes to what we're seeing in the world. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, your own experience in that way?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm part of the privileged class. I grew up in upper middle class household. I went to a liberal arts school that was probably more expensive than other people could afford. My interactions with authorities, including the police, have been relatively pleasant ones. But it's clear my experience is not universal, and my skin color has something to do with that. And we need to pay attention to that as a society, that there's people in this country whose skin color puts them at risk for confrontations with the police. And as sports journalists, we've been sort of pulled to this issue by a number of things, but most recently by Colin Kaepernick, who was trying to draw attention to just this thing when he kneeled during the national anthem. And there was a huge backlash against him for doing that, and he still doesn't have a job in the NFL, despite the fact he was, I don't know if he was the best quarterback in the league or even among the best, but he certainly wasn't among the worst. He was better than average, and he couldn't get a job, and that's indefensible. And it's indefensible that young black men are at more risk of dying from, like, jogging through a neighborhood. And the poor guy in Minnesota, he was already in restraint, and he was killed by the police, and that's inconscionable. And I don't care where you are on the political spectrum, you can't defend that.
I'm with you, Ken. I appreciate you. Appreciate your friendship, and you're a tremendous colleague. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Likewise.
There's Ken Goh of the Oregonian. I think it's well said. I'm going to leave it at that. We've got our big splash coming up. Devon Pouncey, Portland State's play-by-play broadcaster and friend of this show, will be joining us. Also, he was my assistant, or I was his assistant, when it came to coaching CYO basketball. I wonder what those kids thought of us as a coaching staff. I'll ask Pounce that coming up. A lot going on in the world. A lot going on in our country. Probably a lot going on between your ears. I know a lot going on between mine. I'm looking at the headlines today, and it feels like there were simpler times. But maybe we're just more aware now than we've typically been. This brings us to our big splash. It's the one thing that you need to know today.
This is the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where?
Down there.
But the big splash. Brought to you by Sport Clips. Cut the weight. Download the new Sport Clips haircuts app and check in.
Wes Unseld, Hall of Famer, who led the Washington Bullets to the franchise's only NBA championship, died this morning. He was 74 years old. He was selected with the second pick in 1968, made an immediate impact. First season, Bullets won 57 games. That's 21 more wins than the prior year. They made the playoffs for the first time. They stopped being a joke under Wes Unseld. His biggest moment came in 1978 when he and Elvin Hayes led the Bullets to the NBA championship, beating the Seattle Supersonics in seven games. He was the finals MVP, passed away. He was voted into the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame in 1988, and he is a top 50 player in league history. His wife, his daughter Kimberly, his son Wes Jr., and two grandchildren are his survivors. Wes Unseld, dead at the age of 74. That news today. I look back and I look at professional athletes too, and I wonder all the time, like, when a professional athlete passes away, I've not heard an athlete who was in his prime or maybe even retired tell me, like, hey, you know, when I go on my gravestone, I want, you know, the fact that I was an MVP or anything. And what I have found more often than not is that they are more interested in sort of taking, like, the things that they're more relatable in, that they're more interested in their family, their grandchildren, and those things. And I find that all the time. There's kind of a sweet spot, I think, post-retirement for athletes. Because when they're amid it, especially in today's game, professional athletes, we all know, they're like little mini corporations. Not saying they have a stylist and a publicist and a PR team, but they kind of do. And their agent oversees all of that. And everything that they do feels orchestrated and, in a lot of cases, very intentional. And I think sometimes it becomes very easy to go, oh, they're just making an appearance because they're trying to be a good guy. And I don't think we have a sense of who today's athlete, who they really are, even with social media. I don't think we have an accurate depiction of who they really are, like, in their heart in most cases. I think there is a sweet spot, though, post-retirement, where maybe people have stopped paying attention to them, and maybe it comes at, like, age 40 or age 50 for most of these guys, where they kind of look around and they go, hey, like, oh, do people remember me? I'm just glad people remember me. And they get into that stage where they're very relatable. And I know this because we talk to a lot of them on this show. And we've had the chance over the years to talk to athletes on this program who sort of share, like, their ambition for life. And they look back. And, of course, they have fond memories. And, of course, they love the fans. And, of course, they love being a professional athlete. And they love their sport. But I see them more as people. And I think Wes Unseld was one of those guys as he aged and did interviews. And I listened to him and watched him and read about him that I realized, like, you know, basketball is just a piece of what Wes Unseld did. And that goes to my point that I made with Ken Goh earlier. Like, I'm well aware that the prism by which I see the athletes who are competing in college sports and in professional sports, the athletes that I have covered over the years in this business, which will be like 30 years in this business, I am well aware that, you know, they're terrific on the court, they're terrific on the field, and I am judging them admittedly through a narrow view vantage point. Like, I'm not seeing their whole life. And I just think I'm so appreciative of the athletes over the years who have been trusting enough to open up a little bit and share some of that vulnerability with who they are. And I'm talking now about, like, the Damon Stoudemires in the Blazers locker room who have taken the time to go, hey, here's who I am. Brian Grant, another example, former Blazer. who has been very vulnerable and candid in talking about, you know, life after basketball and his family and his upbringing. And, you know, Brian Grant the other night was on the Willamette River with his kids. And I thought, that's where he grew up with his grandfather. Not on that river, but in Ohio. But I think it's amazing to me when we get to know the athletes for more than just maybe their athletic accomplishments, their successes elsewhere. All right, why don't you leave it here? Devon Pouncey's coming up. Play-by-play.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.